Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso, and my guest today, a globally successful Aussie athlete, a bloke that I've been trying to get into the Conversations in Noosa podcast HQ for some time. We spoke many, many years ago when I was still working on commercial radio. I've been a huge fan and admirer of what this bloke does and the sport that he's involved in. So more on my very special guest and the podcast in just a moment. In Noosa is more than a magazine. It's been a vehicle for local community to connect and share stories and ideas. And it's been a place where local businesses and brands thrive. Together with the Conversations in Noosa podcast, In Noosa continues to inform, inspire, and indulge its readers and its listeners. Now, advertising deadlines for the autumn 2019 issue of In Noosa magazine are closing soon. In Noosa magazine distributes 13,000 copies of each issue every season. That's not a cumulative figure, that's every season. And in summer, 15,000 copies are distributed, saturating the Noosa market and Noosa hinterland areas. More copies than any other publication, ensuring that your brand is seen by consumers who live or holiday close to where your business is located. In Noosa is a high-quality coffee table magazine printed on 100% recycled stock, distributed across 15 handcrafted magazine stands, and available in the rooms of high-end accommodation places like the Sofitel, Pepper's Noosa Resort and Villas, and Netanya on Hastings, to name a few. For more details and advertising opportunities for the autumn issue, don't miss out. Email Deb at InNoosaMagazine, all one word, lowercase letters, .com.au. Deb@InNoosaMagazine.com.au or call 0428 853 224. 0428 853 224. Remember, advertising deadlines for In Noosa Magazine's autumn issue closing soon. Now think about this. Population of the world, what is it, about 7.7 billion people? 7.7 billion people in the world today. Imagine for a moment an exclusive environment where only 20 people, out of that 7.7 billion, only 20 people compete in the highest level of a particular endeavor. Today's guest was part of that environment for 12 years, and he topped the highest earning Australian sportspersons list in 2010, beating golfer Greg Norman, who'd been at the top of the list for 15 years. On his Instagram account, Mark Webber describes himself as a country boy. We started the podcast talking about how he reflects on his journey from Queanbeyan, New South Wales, to standing on the top step of Formula One podiums all over the world, to what he's doing today. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, look, it's impossible not to reflect on that journey. I think that very lucky to grow up where I did, because, you know, having travelled the world and competed in my sport, I realised how, you know, a lot of the, you know, simplicity is really, really important. You know, often the case, it's top of the pops on many scenarios in terms of growing up in particular. Like we had a great house. Mum and Dad were brilliant. Leanne, my sister, and we, you know, did a lot of sports, and school was okay. School was fun for me, more fun than it should have been. But yeah, then I just had this, obviously this brutal passion towards racing and going and competing. I think it really evolved late. So then when I started to get into it, you know, it just happens so quick. And then you just get, you're on this wave that you just can't get off. Obviously, you've just got to keep going and going and going. It's 11 months per year. You get like 4 weeks off, obviously. Keep going and going and going. And then you like, yeah, then you say you spat out the other end of it. And it's like, okay, that was a ride, goes fast. And yeah, then you sort of think, wow. And you reflect often, you know, even during your career, clearly, you know, where your upbringing is very, very important, yeah, to you.
And would you say that's what kept you grounded?
I think certainly you need good people around you, you know, which I had with my parents and with Anne, and, you know, pretty small team, to be honest. I didn't have a big, you know, big entourage. It was the same team for my whole career, still is to this day. So it was very intimate, but very trusting and very simple. Yeah, just did the basics well. And I think that, yes, there's parts of the job that you know that, you know, it's clearly abnormal that some of the scenarios that unfold in your profession. Of course, the work that goes towards your car, you know, the individuals. We have, you know, if you look at Red Bull Racing when I was there doing the car alone and then the engine, so combined with Renault and Red Bull technology, you're looking at over 1,000 people preparing two cars to go racing. So that's clearly abnormal. The amount of money involved to find performance is abnormal, and you're the end. You know, you've got to execute on all of that.
Yeah. On Sunday, you and your teammate.
Yep.
Which just brings me to this question, which as an F1 fan, I'd love to ask you. It's clearly a team sport when you talk about the thousands of people involved behind the scenes. But on race day, Mark, when it's you and your teammate, is it a team sport for you out there on the track, or is it everyone for themselves?
It's very much an individual sport at that point. You know, there is flashes of team component that can come into a race, but it's pretty rare that yourself and your teammate. Oh, you know, it's very rare you're going to a race. It's tough enough to win as it is. You're not going there paranoid about just the guy. Obviously, in your team, of course, there's a number of five or six guys that can win on the day, not just one other guy. So you know, when I was racing, you know, I had. You know, there was, as I say, quite a few guys that could win on the day. And you're really just, of course, you're a tremendous amount of focus on yourself and getting all of that done. But, yeah, you really have to just strip it all down. And it's such a, once the visor goes down and there's just so much, of course, all the experience. And there's this, you know, it's all a slow motion and you go into your mode of being a professional in that situation. And then of course there is scenarios that your team might be involved in a scenario, or you might have an absolute pressure cooker with another guy from another team, and you've got to deal with that, which might impact your teammate or might not impact your teammate. So it's very dynamic. But I was going to say, it's quite rare that you hang out with your teammate on the road all the time, you know, all the time. But when you get to the top end of Formula One and you're with the best teams, then it happens more often. And that obviously did happen with me in my career with Sebastian. And you see it now with other drivers. There can be friction, you know, between two teammates, which has been obviously incredibly well documented. But it's an individual sport because it's, as I say, it's 11 months around the clock. Obviously, clearly diet's involved. You know, you've got a lot of pressure on yourself to turn up and deliver. And that's not a sacrifice. I never saw that as a sacrifice or pressure. It's like, this is my bloody job. This is bloody awesome. I love it.
Yeah. Let's talk about that journey. So grew up in Queanbeyan. Was your dad like a motorcycle? Did he sell motorcycles
in Queanbeyan? That's right. Yep. Dad, it was the Yamaha dealer for over 20 years.
Yeah.
His dad had the workshop as well. Clive, who was my granddad, one of my bloody heroes. Clivey and Dad had the shop there for years. Sold the motorbike section. It was still there. When I was sort of the early 90s. So I spent a lot of time on dirt bikes growing up as a youngster. And again, you just do not realize how lucky you are to be able to ride a motorbike in a paddock. Like, it's something simple as that. Like, Australia has those things where that's on to offer, you know. And Dad would like leave a jerry can there and just leave me to it. It's like, mate, I'll come back in. I said, what were you thinking, Dad, back then? Well, that's crazy. You know, like, you know, I was trying to take on these little berms and these little jumps. Yeah. But he just instilled that trust in me. I think that was a great component for me to have the responsibility and the discipline and the trust in myself. He gave me those lessons really early in life that you can hurt yourself on this thing, mate. You know, so just, and I did. I did hurt myself. And I knew that at an early age that you've got to concentrate more, you've got to focus more, you know, and all those things. So anyway, the dealership was great for me, and in a selfish way. It was good. We had a brilliant watchdog there, Aussie, who would be, you'd be locked up now if you had Aussie now, but he used to wipe a few people out. And so it was a lot of character at that shop, a lot of banter, a lot of fun. It was always something going on.
What turned you on to F1? I mean, I as a kid, you know, a lot of Aussie kids probably get switched on to motor racing with the James Harding, what happens at Bathurst, with the touring cars and that kind of stuff. And one of my earliest memories of F1, you didn't get a lot, but on Channel 9 in the 80s, you probably got a race or two that were kind of beamed in on a Saturday afternoon. And I'm talking names like Nelson Piquet and the BMW Palmley-sponsored car and Rennie Arnoux and these kind of names.
Hmm.
Do you remember watching, because I remember watching that and thinking, man, this is like unlike anything I've ever witnessed here in Australia.
Yeah.
Do you remember watching an F1 race and going, that's what I want?
Yeah, I do. It was, I think I was around 8 years old watching the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. I think Mansell crashed up the hill in the JPS Lotus. That was probably one of the first Grand Prix I watched. It was Monaco of all places. As I say, it was raining. It was, and I just saw them as absolute just heroes. Just, you could see, you know, their eyes, you could see the helmets. You see, I was just addicted to so many facets of the sport. And I suppose it wasn't the risk or the speed that you really, it was really just, I suppose, managing the cars, going to all the different types of tracks, and racing against the best guys in the world. So you're right. Early in my life, my dad was fascinated with Formula One, and also he loved, you know, Jack Brabham was his hero, and the single seater scene. So for the listeners, that's like, you know, obviously not touring cars. Single seaters is very much, you know, exactly that, a monocoque. So one seater and not based on a road car at all. So that was Dad's absolute passion, and that just rubbed off on me. So Indy 500 was massive in our house, obviously clearly Formula One, but touring cars in itself was not really, and that just washed off from Dad. It was like, well, whatever Dad thinks cool, I think is cool as well. Yeah. But so, and obviously that's not cool or not as cool. So, and it wasn't as cool. Like, you know, we never went to Bathurst. Dad and I never went to Bathurst right. ever. Imagine. And
it would have been pretty close though,
yeah,
right?
Very close. 3 hours. I've been there more since I've stopped than I, you know, growing up. Like, clearly that was a religion, you know, but just didn't really,
it was always the open wheelers,
resonate. Yeah. Didn't resonate with Dad, so then that didn't resonate with me.
Mark, it takes a lot of commitment, passion and cash for an Aussie to travel to the Northern Hemisphere and give F1 a red hot go. And union player David Campisi was instrumental in helping you along in the early days.
I mean, where do I start with the journey to go over there? I mean, it's just, there's so many parts of the jigsaw. It's just incredible. You've got these, you know, 5,000 pieces on the floor all over the place, and you've got to start, you know, putting it together. But because, we spoke about Sir Jack, you know, and AJ with their success, and we had success on two wheels too, obviously, with Wayne, you know, in my generation with Wayne and Mick doing. So clearly you can see it's possible, but it's really, really tough. And people, you know, to the uneducated, going, well, how can it be so hard? Like, you know, getting over there and just driving and proving what you can do. Well, yes, but it's back to the individual sport. There's a lot of people doing it. As we sit here today, there's only four guys that have won, four Australians have, I think it's whatever, 60, 70 years have won a Grand Prix. So it's pretty thin on the ground, but it's hard to get through. Campo, yes, he did support me in 1997, which was tremendous. Knew him from Queanbeyan with my dad through rugby union, so that's a really, really nice story. And David just saw, I think, the tenacity and the passion that I had towards it, and that's why he just subscribed to sort of supporting me pretty quickly. I drove a shitbox Ford Laser to Heathrow Airport, 1.1 Ford Laser, parked it at the front. I knew the Wallabies were going through the airport and come down with me. I doorstopped Campo with a bit of a proposal. I said, mate, look, I'm on the bones of my ass. I'm going to be going back to Australia pretty quickly as well. Last thing I want to be doing is going back with my tail between my legs. And when he landed back in Australia, I said, yeah, I'll give you a bit of coin to keep you going. So it was great.
You often hear for Aussies to move to go to the Northern Hemisphere in the UK and Europe to participate in something like this. They talk about the cultural difference.
Mm.
Well, what did you experience? What do they mean by that? Is it culturally different for an Aussie?
Well, it is, because in Australia we have no culture. So that's the first thing. So, you know, I suppose that's something you've got to get your head around. We have culture, of course. I mean, you know, not as much, obviously. We're a young country, you know, so we go over there.
History.
We're relatively basic people, the Aussies. Yeah. You know, we go about what we do, but, you know, you land at Heathrow, and if you go into London, for example, you know, what the hell's all this, you know? So most of us are nearly country at heart in Australia, if you get my drift, I suppose. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you grew up in Sydney, Melbourne, whatever, bigger towns, but very small population in Australia by the landmass. And of course, it's just, isn't it? It's just all the little things, you know, what you eat, you know, how people talk to each other, how they mingle, where's the banter, where's the sort of innuendo of all those sort of small things, and that's in the UK, which is already a little bit of a, you know, it is a difference. The weather's atrocious, you know, so there's things, you know, so they're all lifestyle things you just got to, you know, change gear on. But then you want to go and hang out in Spain or France, or, you know, they do not care. I mean, it's a bit of a novelty factor from Australia. Oh, good, that's fantastic. Then, like, you know, get into it, you know, menu, knowingly, you know, back. You get in. I lived in Germany for 6 months in the late 90s. I mean, that was, you know, in a play in a Falder bar outside Stuttgart, and you think, you know, and that's where the Swabians are. They talk about, I mean, Swabians. A Swabian, even the Germans say they are really German, and that is, you know, that's a culture shock.
Yeah.
That is a culture shock when you can sit down and they will sit there for 3 hours and they will not speak a word of English. That's a tough evening out. But what can you do? You can come home and say they don't speak English, they don't speak Australian, yeah. I can't get Vegemite. Well, mate, you're not going to survive.
Yeah.
You know, you got to integrate with what you got to do to make those small lifestyle things work for you, and not affect you in the car, the performance. Excuse me, the performance you've got to, it can't affect you in the car. So you got to learn that pretty quick.
I want to talk about your first. I think it's 2002. My father-in-law's got a framed photo of that accident. I think it was at the start. Is it Rubens Barrichello and Ralf Schumacher came together?
Mm.
And that was your first race with Minardi.
Yep.
Fifth?
Yep.
Home race.
Oh, Australian race. First race as well.
First race.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it literally, when they talk about, oh, it's a dream and you know, oh, you got to pinch yourself and all, it was an out-of-body experience. Just could not be happening. This cannot be happening. It's my first race. First of all, the car was notoriously prepared, you know, in terms of how, you know, reliability-wise, we were very much on the back foot in preparation for that race. Very small team. I drove for the Italian team for a year. That was my entry into Formula One. Great guys. Typical Italian, obviously, very long lunches. And, you know, it was they were so much love. You could not like them. The guys were brilliant, and I still have a tremendous relationship with them, you know, to this day. But, yeah, we started the race, and as you say, there was a huge pile up at the first corner. Any other day, I reckon it would have been red flagged and restarted, but I think because maybe the officials, I've got no idea, and I still don't know to this day, but they kept the race on, you know, and like, which was a huge benefit to me because there was carnage, there's guys in the wall everywhere. And as the race went on and on and on, I thought, this is looking pretty amazing. The team boss at the time said before the race, if you can just finish the race, it will be incredible. Just get this car home, mate. After 2 hours, you can get it. Like, I hardly fit in the car because, again, prep was late. My knees were purple. My elbows were purple. I was way too small for the car. And because it was mainly built around Italian drivers. Minardi famously had Italian drivers forever. And then they had this massively tall Australian from nowhere, you know, having to drive for them, which, with this result, they certainly loved me after that. And then Stoddy rang up the boss and he said, look, when I was running fifth, he said, under no circumstances should you let Mika Salo, who was this guy catching me in a much faster car, pass. You know, so he was now doubling down on the result. He said, mate, you need to do not let him pass. And it was quite funny how this out-of-body sort of, again, experience was like, actually, yeah, you know what, I'm actually ready for this. I'm ready for the fight. I was actually really calm. I said, you know what, like, I've been here before, which was how I hadn't. Every single meter of that was a new experience to me. That whole race was so new. But I said, when he arrives here, this is a guy with 100 Grand Prix under his belt. He's like, you know, very experienced, and I'm going to be hard with him. And that was quite a moment I'm pretty proud of, actually, to even though it was a really small, pathetic little battle, but in the scheme of the experience I had and what was on the table, it worked out pretty well.
Just going back to the start of that race where I think it was Ralf Schumacher's car was airborne. You've been airborne a couple of times.
Yeah.
I think once in F1,
yep.
Which had an onboard camera.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one was it the Porsche?
Mercedes.
The Mercedes?
Yep.
What goes through your brain after something like that? Because I did, on that second one with the Mercedes, I think it was on your Instagram, you said something along the lines of, it changed my career or my life for the better.
No racing driver wants to have big shunts, but it comes with a territory. You might have one or two huge ones in your career, like we saw Fernando have a big one not long ago with it at Albert Park. We've seen, I'm trying to pick guys that you think are relatively measured and didn't have many, but Fernando did, and he's one of the most accurate guys ever, but he got that wrong down in turn three in Albert Park. Jensen had a big one in excuse me, in Monaco, out of the tunnel, it was knocked out. You know, that was a nasty, nasty shunt. So when you have a career as long as I suppose us guys did, then clearly the dice is loaded towards, you know, there could be a day where there will be an error of judgment. And the Valencia crash was where the Le Mans crashes were sort of a car that was notoriously unstable by regulation. Those cars were unsafe, and we lost a lot of cars, not just Mercedes, but we lost our competitors also. The type of regulation that the cars were designed around were flying quite a bit of that time, and tragically we lost Michele Albreto. He lost his life in Germany in a similar type of accident with a right rear puncher, and the car did take off, and he didn't make it, unfortunately. So those cars were dangerous, and I mean, so yeah, it's uncomfortable. Mentally, you've got to understand it very quickly. So that's reassuring for me that, okay, I did nothing wrong, but you can't, the mind's very clever at, you know, slowing things down, calibrating that, you know, clearly you're in a very, very, very compromised position here. It could go either way. Like, you know, if you're into the trees or if you're in somewhere, then, so you're very calm. It's amazing how calm you are, given that, you know, within a second, you know, you could pay the ultimate price. So yeah. I was not panicking at all. I was actually relatively calm. But and the second one was, because they happened both close together, which was extraordinary, really. And the second one, I just didn't want any pain. I just said, like, I can't be lucky twice. Like, there's something going to happen on this one, because you can't be so lucky twice. And I was lucky twice, but you just, again, I was calm. But I was like, you know, if something happens, which most people listening will probably think is absolutely crazy. But when the mind goes into such a fight or flight situation, it just is like that. And so I just thought, okay, well, I don't want any pain, and I'm not going to be lucky as was the first time, which I was. And then I walked away. But that was the last time I drove a sports car, yeah, until I went back to Porsche years later. But when I said it was a making of me in your question there, so that put me back on my original trajectory of racing single seaters again. So yeah, that was a blessing in a way. It was quite ironic.
Take Formula One fans on into the inner circle and describe something, or tell me something that they may not know about being a driver. And I'll give you an example. I think it was Damon Hill wrote an article once, and because I'll never get the experience of sitting in an F1 car. And he was describing a lap, and he said that he was so, you know, you're so tightly harnessed into the cockpit that the G-forces on acceleration, and even on braking, and it really resonated with me. He said, you could feel your inner organs moving inside of your body.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an insight into what it's like that a lot of fans of the racing wouldn't understand. Is there something you can tell me about what it's like being strapped into one of those cars?
Every single time I've strapped a sports person or a friend, or which is rare, but you know, when I've had the scenario to have them at the track after a race, you know, they, you know, sit in the car and they just go, what really hits them, even my mum sat in my race car, which is pretty cool. Mum sat in my Formula One car. She said, Christ, Mark, I can't get back out of it. My bloody fat ass, I can't get out of it. Mum, it's right, you haven't got a fat ass. But she's like, it was just, yeah. So that was a laugh. And all the boys, we're going to leave her there. Because because you sit so low. So the first thing is, when we say low, so if you sit on the ground and you put, like, it's like sitting in a bath. Like, you're literally, your ass is pretty much on the ground in a Formula One car. You don't realize how low you are. So your eye line, so the sensation for speed is incredibly high because you're low. And your vision, that's the other thing. They sit in the car and they say, we can't see anything. How can you, because on TV, we've got this beautiful, you know, 360, you know, sort of take on, you know, where all the cars are, all looks pretty cushy. But when you sit in the car, they're like, okay, great. So then you put the headrest in. It's like, okay, oh, they don't like it, to be claustrophobic. Put the belts on. And then the big sucker punch is, it's like, you haven't even got a helmet on yet. And you literally, you know, once you put a helmet on, which is like looking outside of a letterbox. And then you go to Damon's point of obviously the intensity of the cars, the acceleration, you know, your breathing rate on a normal lap on a high speed circuit, somewhere like Barcelona or Suzuka or Silverstone. Those three circuits, just off the top of my head, are very, very high speed. And why I mention those tracks is because the higher the speed of the corners are, your breathing rate is disrupted the most, because you have to hold your breath. You cannot just breathe. Like when you run and cycle, of course, or, you know, you bring it in and take it out as much as you can. But, you know, in a Grand Prix car, you have to hold your breath. And sort of that Valsalvaing, what we call sort of like a bit like a tackle in AFL or rugby league when you're about to get hit, you don't sort of just, oh, I'll just exhale and get, you know, get the wind knocked out. I mean, not have that power in the body. You need the power and the load to get through those high-speed corners. So, and then obviously your heart rate will, you know, accelerate to a degree, but then obviously comes down because you're in amazing condition. You're obviously in really, really good shape because you have to do this for 2 hours.
Does vision ever go blurry on acceleration or braking?
No, I mean, braking is, I've seen like maybe sort of the, like a drop of sweat go towards the visor on braking. So if you're looking at like 5G, I mean, this is when the cars were very light back in the day. I know they're doing some big G-forces again now, but so yeah, that's the biggest thing which people just would not accept. You know, just when the corner is there and we're still full throttle, you know, you can be doing 340k an hour and they can see the corner. You know, for 99.99% of people just shouldn't apply for that type of, because they're not cut out for it. It's as simple as that.
You're talking about the extreme physical fitness and the kind of fitness regime that you've been a part of, Mark, and you know Lewis Hamilton's all over Instagram exercising. I remember photos of Keke Rosberg sitting on the front tyre having a cigarette. Those days, they don't exist anymore. Obviously, it's super. Talk about your fitness regime, because I know you cycle, you run, you've got a number of events, the Tasmanian event that you get involved with.
Yeah.
During a, say you were still in the F1 game, how much training would you put into it?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Keke there. I mean, I think all sports naturally, you know,
they've all evolved.
Things have moved on. We know that. I mean, you know, a lot of footballers were obviously having a few darts before they'd play, have a dart maybe at halftime. And it has moved on. And I think bizarrely in that era in Formula One, I'm not saying they were having, you know, the odd bit of alcohol. They certainly weren't driving on the influence of alcohol. But in terms of they lost a lot of mates. They lost a lot of buddies in the 70s. There was a lot of fatalities in our sport. And I think they needed that, you know, that release, I suppose, a bit of escapism. I'm not saying the alcohol was, but in terms of they really had to, you know, try and relax and unwind in between a lot of those tragic events.
Well, James Hunt used to like to party.
Of course, yes. You know, he didn't need any encouragement. I don't think it was in relation to going to any funerals, because he was still happy to, you know, he was, you know, the ultimate womanizer, as you all know. But because, I mean, I had talent, but I wasn't the most gifted driver. So I had to, and I was tall, unfortunately. So my weight was an issue. So I had to be very lean and apply myself to that job as best I could. So yeah, of course, you're doing two sessions a day, 6 days a week, and you know, people would say, okay, that's fine, that's easy. But another thing that sort of surprised people is, I suppose, we've had guests come to Grand Prix on the Thursday, and it's like, we've hardly seen Mark. And it's like, yeah, well, but he only does a couple of sessions and then does qualify in the race. And it's like, yeah, but there's Thursday to Sunday, we have, a lot of meetings, a lot of commitment. I'm not, you know, so it's very well organized. We have our fitness, you know, in and around that, which is not much at race weekends. But then you've got, not like a lot of other sports, yes, tennis and golf, they do a tremendous amount of travel. But, you know, in the early 2000s, when you're doing 250 nights in hotels a year, and you're doing like up to 90 to 100 flights.
Mark, I just want to pick up on something you said a couple of minutes ago. You never considered yourself a talented Formula One driver?
There is guy. I raced against guys in the junior cars who had more skill than I did, but then, of course, then the application, he's not there, which is a great topic with maybe some of our tennis players here in Australia at the moment, obviously, particularly, you know, someone like Kyrgios, clearly insane talent. You know, the skill the guy's got.
But not discipline.
Yeah, of course. He hasn't got the mind for it. I mean, this guy, he put him in a racing car. I mean, that is just if he was in our game, he wouldn't be allowed in the track nearly, because he just has not got that mind management.
You always appear to be cool, calm and collected on the track. Whereas if you look at other drivers, Schumacher, Senna, Prost, Vettel, even Hamilton from time to time, it was a win at all cost kind of attitude and approach.
Oh yeah, I wasn't an angel, mate. You have flashes of moments where, you know, you might have a bit of yeah, you've got split second decisions, and sometimes they're not always right. And you are
sure
you are. You know, you can't be after you, sir, all the time. You've got to be a bit of a you have to have some mongrel. There's no question about it. You need some mongrel in you, otherwise. And they all have all those guys you just mentioned. For all of the, you know, it's like Roger Federer. You know, Roger. I mean, you know, but he has got mongrel. He's a winner. You know, he wants to, and he will go. He's got to try and find ways. And will there be some trickery? Will be there the odd thing that he can put his competitor off? Absolutely. Like Roger is like that. He's the ultimate, nearly the ultimate. You know. Role like in these days, you know, how perfect you are to be the role model, you know, trophy captain's insane, endorsing the best brands in the world.
Yeah.
Incredible sports person, no question about it. He's the template, but extremely rare that it's like that. And as with all these top flight sports people, there is an edge. And there has to be an edge. And that's how they get to the top, because they are prepared to do things that others aren't. You have to be prepared to do things that others aren't. If you're going to do the same as everyone else, then you're not going to get there, because you've got to do something different. You know, you've got to be actually application or discipline, or you've got to have more skill, or you've got to have lots of columns covered off that you are then going to be, you know, outstanding and magical and excellent at your trade, being a professional. If you're one of 500, who cares? You know, but if you're one of 10, that's, you're getting in that last slot then, right?
Yeah. But you were there. I always think about this with F1. It's an elite club. You know, when you think about how many people there are in the world, and on a Sunday afternoon, there's only 20, well, there could have been various numbers over the years, 20, 24, there's only 20 people in that club. Is it a super license that they're granted?
Yep, super license, yep.
That have one of those. And you were there.
It's a motorsport category really on its own in terms of trying to prepare for it. You know, like there was no simulators again back then. There's simulators now, but which helps to a degree, obviously. But, you know, the simulator doesn't help how you interact with people, you know, how you deal with pressure, how you deal with lots of other components of being a professional that, you know, computer doesn't do that for you. You've got to actually... Yeah. You know, when these all these split second decisions that you've got to make about strategy, what have I got to do here? Have I got to, you know, back up me making demands on the team? You know, when I put demands on someone to deliver for me on that, I want that from you. You need to deliver that, whether it's 5 minutes or half an hour or 3 months or whatever. It could be a development item, whatever it is. And then you got to deliver on that. So, yeah, it's one of 24, but the hardest tracks in the world, the quickest cars in the world, and that's why it's the sport it has been for so long.
Yeah. We could talk Formula One all day, but let's move on to other things. Mark, your connection to Noosa, explain that.
Came here for the first time in 2002, actually after that race. We spoke about the first Grand Prix. Anne, who's sitting in the room here now, I've got to get this right. Yeah, in-laws, Anne's previous husband, Rod, his parents are up here. So it's sort of like, it's amazing. And they're both from Tasmania, both sides of that. So it's quite interesting how everyone sort of has ended up here from sort of Anne's background, let's say. And so Annie was keen to come and check it out well and truly underway in our relationship then, and just said, yeah, well, it'd be good to come see Noosa, which we did. Yeah, so we used to rent year after year up here, and then I said, this place got to change. It cannot be this good forever. You know, like it's pretty amazing, but I
thought it was going to get over commercialized.
Well, whatever. I don't think we should buy here. I should, you know, we'll see how we go. In the end, we'll stuff it. Yes, it hasn't changed that much in a good way. You know, it's, of course, it has moved on a lot, you know, but it's. It's, you know, it's a little piece of jewelry. We love coming here for a little bit of a break.
Anonymity. Like, no one would recognize you, really.
Very good here. I mean, it's, which I'm.
No one hassles I'm cool you. With. I think I hassled you about 16 years ago.
Yeah,
And we're walking down Hastings Street, and you walked one way. And again, no one was staring at you. No one stopping you for nothing. Yeah. And we walked past, and I said to my wife, Deb, I said, that's Mark Webber.
Yeah.
I was working on local radio at the time. So I think I'm going to go back and ask him if he wants to do an interview.
Yeah.
So I ran back to you and I said, look, I work on CFM and would you be interested? And you were very polite and you said, no, look, when I'm here, I don't want to.
Well, so, okay, good. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And, but I've
I was happy
you
I was polite.
Yeah. Yeah, but I've seen you out as well, you know, at the Japanese restaurant there more recently. And and again, it's anonymity. What's the word? Anonymity.
Yeah.
No one hassles you, feel comfortable here. You surf?
Not enough. Not enough. It looks too serious. Everyone gets a bit too focused on the whole thing. And look, I had my life ran by... Yeah, lots of other things so long that I'm happy to just come here and chill out. And but I like my fitness. I love, you know, it's a great bunch of people here. It's, as you say, it's a safe town now. Always has been safe, but you know, it's safe to be, you know, compared to a lot of other places in the world. It's incredibly safe. And it's good to see, you know, that the little tackers can, you know, grow up in an environment like that and be involved in the ocean. And, you know, look, it's not, we've had a lot of European friends come out here and they've loved it. But if the ocean's not for you, then obviously after that, it's like, what do we do here? You know, so if there can be, if they love it, then it's like, but if the ocean's not for them, then they're like, what do we do here?
Yeah, there's not a lot else, is there?
What do you do? It's like, okay, yeah. So look, there's it's spectacular, and we absolutely love coming here. My family love coming here.
And it's clean, it's pristine.
Absolutely.
Far more than I have. A friend has a good quote. He travels a bit too, and he goes, the best thing about traveling is coming home.
Yes.
And you've seen a lot more of the world than I have.
Yeah.
And so the fact that, you know, you go,
look, just,
you know,
infrastructure, mate, it's very good. Health is good. You know, so there's a lot of things. I think, is it the new hospital down?
It's down at Kiwanis.
I hear that's just world class. So, you know, the whole area is pretty unique. We know that. Love the wildlife and all those things. Which
I saw your photo of the python.
A lot of
in the backyard.
Yeah, exactly, in the backyard. Yeah,
still
there? Yeah, no, he's gone now. Well, she's gone now. Yeah, she's gone. But those things you take for granted. You know, growing up in Australia, we take a lot of that. You know, the birds and the koalas and like all this beautiful stuff that we have here in nature in Australia, and we really do take it for granted, where the Europeans will be like, wow, like that is just incredible. Yeah. So it's good to be here and soak some of that up.
I want to talk about your apparel range now. Mm. Aussie Grit, it's a handle that you've had for a long time.
Yep.
And so now Aussie Grit Apparel, and you're doing some functions all around the world. Well, you're doing some runs and staging a couple of events.
Well, because I've always enjoyed the outdoors, always enjoyed my fitness, and I had a wardrobe full of 15, 20 different brands of sort of selections of what I liked, what I didn't like, you know. And I said, you know what? You know, the Australian story, let's have the Aussie Grit story come alive here and let people wear our brand, wear our gear in the environment they love to go and exercise and compete in or whatever they want to do. So that's where the idea was born out of. And it's off-road running, it's mountain biking, mainly in the UK and Australia. We are online, Aussie Grit Apparel, we are online. We just had our best month in January, and February's, we're ahead of that already now. I don't know if this is time-stamped the interview when you're going to put this out. But anyway, this is February now, listeners. It is February. I don't know when John's going to put it out. But very small little team. And it's a great thing. And it's the overnight sensation is 10 years, as we know. We've got to work hard. We've had a lot of tremendous feedback. It's what, when comfy meets tough, really. I just wanted all the products to be really durable. You know, the wash quality, the comfort. And all the fabric selections we've been very, very, you know, strict on, clearly. We've got some great sourcing and manufacturing partners as well, which we would never have got anywhere near that type of level if it wasn't for the racing background. So that's been really, really, really great.
And
so, yeah.
Just online or in retail?
Retail. Well? We're going to do a bit in Brizzy coming up soon. We've got some meetings down there in the next few weeks. Sydney's underway retail-wise in specialised retail. So we've got Pace Athletic in Manly. We've got Ranulla in Cronulla there. So there is some stores. We've got five or six in Sydney and a couple in Melbourne. But we need to get Brisbane fired up. And also, you know, maybe we can get some gear up here in Noosa. But online... we can.
What's the web address?
AussieGridApparel.com. Yep.
Awesome.
Yep. So, yeah.
There's so many other things, but I'm aware that you're tight for time and ambassador of Porsche. Do you like doing the commentary for 10?
Is
that
look,
the only one you do?
Yeah. It is in Australia. Yeah. I do 10 other races in Europe for Channel 4 and for UK TV.
Right.
Yep. So I do all the UK TV. Look, I haven't got really a big journalistic bone in my body in terms of asking, you know, a truckload of questions on like what you're doing with me today is a skill, and a lot of people don't realize that. So for me to get that, enthusiastic about asking in the field that I spent so long in to go and talk to people.
Inside intel.
But when it comes to drivers, I very much enjoy talking about that, about what they're going through, the pressures of their job, putting the perfect lap together, putting a perfect Grand Prix together. So if I can demonstrate that back to the viewer and make them understand more about our sport, not in a condescending or patronizing way, but just really, you know, glue them to the sport a bit better. That's enjoyable. And it's about them. It's not about, you know, I think there's a few pundits that actually still struggle to get off the horse and still rave on about them bloody selves. You know, it's not about, you know, I want to talk about them. You know, I'm the voice of,
yeah.
I'm just execute what I've got some experience clearly and I can validate a lot of the things that I might see or a scenario or an experience, but it's not, you know, I'm not, you know, on the bongo drums about myself. So, no. I enjoy doing that.
And to finish off, Mark, what kind of year do you reckon Daniel Ricciardo is going to have with Renault?
I think it'll be okay. Look, I like the Enstone guys there. So there's two components there. Again, you've got where the car is built, which is in the UK, and then Renault clearly do the engine in France, in Viry there, in just south of Paris. So I'm a bit worried about the second part of that with Renault supplying the engine because they haven't had a great run of late, and that's a key component to his success. So he needs to be... in for the long haul there. When I say long haul, it's 2 years.
To develop the car, see
how he goes with that. And that's going to take some batteries. He needs to be in a good place mentally to deal with the amount of energy that's going to require for him to put the work in there. And as long as he's got his head around that, then he's going to be in good shape then for 21 to probably select another team and go again. But the next 2 years are crucial because we know there's a lot of youngsters coming through. Daniel's world class. He's absolute world class. He's great to watch. He's great for the sport. He's we're all proud of him. Yeah. But in terms of, I would like to have seen him stay. I've been a broken record on this because obviously it's a topic and everyone asks me about it, but I would like to see him stay at Red Bull because there's no question about it. I think he would have more. He'll have better results at Red Bull in the next 24 months than he probably will at Renault. But let's see. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mark Webber was my very special guest today. Conversations in Noosa. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I enjoyed recording it. Check out his social media platforms at Aussie Grit and Aussie Grit Apparel, his new apparel range. If you enjoyed the podcast, share it about on your social media networks with friends, family, and whoever. And rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you streamed or listened to it on, maybe Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Wooshka, Google, whatever. Until next time, take care.